My name is Peter Zaitsev, and I'm going to talk to you about Linux performance measurement, how to measure it right, and hopefully a bit, no, how to measure it wrong, and a bit about how to measure it right as well. I run Pirkona, and we specialize in open source databases, but you typically run open source database on open source operating systems, which those days most commonly runs Linux, right? So we do have a lot of experience and needs to look into the Linux Linux performance. Now, Linux performance is a very kind of broad topic, right? You can literally find a lot of very thick books about that, and I have, what, about just 25 minutes? So I decided I'll talk high level and focus on the four primary resources, right, which are typically going to drive your system performance, right? Obviously, CPU, memory, disk, storage, and network. Now, when we speak about understanding the performance as it relates to those components, that does not mean what if your CPU is a problem, then you just need to go ahead and get more CPU. Well, your cloud vendors probably would exactly want you to do that, right? To do a tuning by the credit card. But maybe that is not what you want to do, and you want to understand what's actually causing the usage and how you want to resolve it. But with that, you at least need to understand what there is resource utilization, right, which comes to that particular resource, right, because that's how you can, change your application workload, right, and so on and so forth. Now, I think another important thing to understand about resources, right, which will go through a lot of questions here, is to understand what when you have resources, they have some sort of natural concurrency with which they can execute workload well, right? So, for example, if you look your CPU, it probably has multiple CPU threads, CPU cores, which can execute more or less in a parallel. But if you have more tasks which need CPU, they can be queued. If you have a spinning disk, it also can execute only one I/O request at a time, right? Your RAID volume or SSD can execute more of them at the time, but all of them have some sort of concurrency with which they can perform well. Afterward, queuing happens, and what is about queuing is queuing always adds to latency, right? And latency is exactly how your end users experience performance. Make sense? Okay. So if you want learn more about the methodology, for it applies to Linux, but also other systems as well, I would suggest you to check out this use method, utilization, saturation, errors. The best coverage is on the Brendan Gregg's. You can also find some of my presentations talking about this use method. So there's a lot of good stuff out there, but that is not what I'm going to speak here today. Okay, let's start with some typical mistakes which you see in Linux, right? I think one of the most common misconceptions is the load average. Who here loves load average? Okay, some hands. Good. So in so many cases, I see people are reading in load average, maybe making some monitoring about that and saying, oh, there is a magic number if a load average is more than 5. Then that's bad, right? Anybody heard those things? And I think that is a problem, right? So, for example, this server has, quite high load average, right? It's floating between 40 and 60. But I can tell what that server has, 80 CPU cores, and it's really not really breaking a sweat, right? Load average, while it can be used to get some insight in your system, a lot of people do not really understand it and look at that as a magic number, right? What kind of problems do we see with load average? One, it really mixes I/O and CPU usage together, right? You can have very I/O intensive workload and very CPU intensive. They both may have a very high load average, so you don't really quite know what it is. It is not really normalized, right? As I mentioned, if you have a lot of CPU cores, right? And those days, I think we operate in very interesting space where you can have like a development VM spun out, right, which has just one CPU core, or we can have a production system which have a 100 plus CPU cores, right? That is a two orders of magnitude difference, right? And that really means that we cannot use their magic numbers, which we could when all the servers would just, maybe a decade ago or more, right, have one, two, maybe four CPU cores, right? In those case, load average 20 is kind of bad for everyone, right? So it's not normalized, and it also has a lot of computational artifacts, especially in Linux, right? If you are interested about those computational artifacts, check this thing out, right? Again, from Brandon Gregg, he does a lot of fantastic work, and Linux load average, that is one thing what he wrote about relatively recently. Now, what I like to look at the very least is to separate their I/O load, right, queue, and the CPU load separately, right? That is essentially the same load average, but split out. And in this case, I can see if I normalize my CPU load, right, it's actually quite low. There is no waiting task, but there is some, I/O fluctuation. The fluctuation is going on. Now, even better, how you can look at the CPU and some other resource utilization is PSI, pressure stall information. Anybody heard about this? Yes, cool stuff, right? So it is the new stuff, right? It is getting in the new kernels, right? So it may not be available to the all Linux distributions, right? So I think for practical purpose, that will be useful like in a couple of years. But it is very cool because that allows us to really to understand from a latency standpoint, right, what given task is being blocked. When it's being kind of blocked by waiting CPU run queue, when it's being blocked waiting on disk I/O, when it's kind of being blocked by, because of a memory pressure, right, which gives us a very good information about the performance, how it impacts the end user, instead of focusing on some magic numbers, right, which people often want to read. And again, here's a URL with more information available. Now, what you can do right now, and which is fantastic for monitoring here, is to use eBPF, right? There is a number of ways you can use and consume that information. So, for example, there is a Cloudflare's exporter, right, where you can get that information to Prometheus for monitoring. Here is a little command line tool from BCC tool collection, where you can actually look at the run queue latency or how much it takes before the task is scheduled on the CPU. Obviously, if it's scheduled almost immediately, then that means there was a CPU available, right? It wasn't waiting long, right? Whatever your kind of CPU usage graphs or whatever showing you. And if it's high, well, then it was not scheduled for a long time. What is a good thing in this case, it also takes care of some complicated cases which CPU usage alone is not going to show you, right? For example, Linux CPU scheduler is a complicated beast, right? Especially in NUMA environments and so on and so forth, right? So if for whatever logic it does, right, it just took a long time to schedule, your user will be impacted. You won't see that in a CPU utilization graphs, but you will see that in a run queue latency information. Now, another mistake, if you will. So this is an example from Prometheus, right, which obviously tells us the different modes of a CPU usage. And there are many of them here, right? I mean, you can see, like, I remember it used to be like user system and kind of idle, right? You would be thinking about FreeFM. So which FM really corresponds to the CPU being used here, right? Your CPU is actually being used. I have seen a lot of kind of graphs, recommendation, internet, and saying, oh, let's run a query, and everything which is not idle is CPU used, right? Which is not really the case, because of at least two important misconceptions. First is I/O wait. I/O wait is idle. From CPU standpoint, the CPU is idle when it's in kind of I/O wait state. Yes, it was decided for convenience to add another state for that, idle when there is no disk I/O going on, and idle when there is disk I/O going on, right? But from CPU standpoint, if you have a system which shows 99 CPU in I/O wait state, it's not CPU bottleneck, right? It's I/O bottleneck. The second thing which I often see misconstrued is still, right? In VM environments and some cloud environments, that corresponds with CPU which is not really used by your application on anything you are doing if you're in your box, but neighbors, VM, right, whatever, your cloud provider putting you on a diet, right, or whatever other things, but it needs to be understood and measured separately. Now, with the modern CPUs, there is even more fun when it comes to understanding CPU performance and understanding, right? So, for example, modern CPUs change frequency of a load, right? Sometimes it might be as much as 5x, right? That means if you have a very idle system, one CPU usage at 800 megahertz, right, is very different than the same kind of 1% and 5 gigahertz, right, or 4 gigahertz, or whatever it can burst to, right? Also, peak core frequency which the system can provide depends on the load, on particular load you're running on the core, right, and also on number of cores used, right? And not to mention what there are, you know, virtual cores are not the same in terms of real cores. Now, in this case, from a utilization standpoint, if your CPU is close to saturation, you will see that wherever you want. But it is important to understanding the capacity planning, right? Because if you know your application is kind of scales, you know, semi-linearly in the workload, and you can see, oh, I see my CPU use only 5%, so I can, you know, probably get at least 20x from my application. That may not be the case because of all that kind of complicated math which is going into how CPU scale in those days. Okay, disk. In terms of disk, there are actually two things you have to take care about. Disk space, simple, right? You don't want to run out of disk space. And disk as I/O performance. Now, with a simple disk space, there is also a mistake I see a lot of people are doing, or some people, is the understanding, not knowing the difference between size of file length and a disk usage. So in this case, I created a test file, 16 gigabytes. But if you look at DU, it's only take 4 kilobytes, because that is a sparse file, which is a one giant 16 gigabyte hole. Right. Of course, you're not likely to see this kind of a difference in the real world, but you can, right, because there are a number of systems using sparse files for different things. For example, in MySQL, some of the table compression is used by with a hole punching, right, and a disk space used versus file length may be substantially different. Now, when you speak about the disk from performance standpoint, you need to consider you know, a number of things here, right? Obviously, there is IOPS, how much it can do, and the bandwidth. They're not quite replaceable. Both can be their bottleneck, especially when it comes to the network-attached storage or slower buses. Like, for example, if somebody noticed what the all SATA SSDs exactly deliver 500 megabytes a second. Anybody notice that? Why? Because the SSDs are so damn fast, but SATA bus is so damn slow, right, in this case. So that is the limit out there. You also need to understand the different types of load the disk says, right? Reads, writes, fsyncs, because they do have different latency and load implication. And also your load concurrency, right, also often referred as a QDEF when it comes to the disk, right? Because again, remember we spoke about concurrencies, how many requests the system can process in parallel effectively, and that's typically when its peak throughput is achieved. So from typical mistakes, my IO style disutilization number is hitting 100%. Right? I have seen so many times this kind of being so much scared about 100%, there's no way to go, right? Oh my gosh. Well, reality is what that IO style utilization number means is percent of the time when at least one IO request was outstanding, right? It may make sense again for single spinning drives in the last decade, right, or last millennia, right? But it doesn't really make sense for common storage we use those days. It doesn't make sense for SSDs. It doesn't make sense for RAIDs. It doesn't make sense for NAS. It doesn't make sense on the cloud storage because they are very good at processing multiple requests at a time, and where you have one request outstanding or kind of two, three, typically performance, the latency at least would not be impacted. What I like plotting here is looking at two things. One is separating reads and writes latency, right? Where that is exponential graph, right? So depending on your system, the difference between read and write latency may be very significant. Some systems actually has a better read latency. Some has better write latency, right? And in this case, what I do is I compare their current latency to their kind of average latency, which I've seen on this system over the last period of time, so I can understand when it's abnormal, right? Relatively easy. So that is one thing I find quite helpful. The second thing is what I look at what we call a disk load here. That also can be the average disk queue, right? How many requests are going on at the same time? Because if you're really saturating your disk, right, queuing happen, then this thing typically just go out, becomes quite high. And also what you you can typically kind of compare that, right, to what exactly your storage is expected to be able to optimally handle. The problem is, of course, is if you think about the cloud storage or something like that, you don't really know how many, what is the optimal concurrency, right? They don't tell, and that's going to be implementation dependent, which can change at any point in time. The next thing is your latency, which, again, you can get from eBPF, and where you do not need to really look at the just the average latency. You can look at the distribution, which can be done on IO device. There are also tools where you can look at that on a file system level, which is more interesting because that is where you can also see your cache efficiency, as well as you can look at some more of the outliers, right? For example, sometimes for a single IO, because of some metadata things like file system, I need to do a lot of IOs, right, to do some locking, which can make IO much slower than your physical IO would require, right? So this is with tools for ext4. There's also ones for XFS and some other common file systems. Okay. In terms of memory, again, we look at the physical memory and virtual memory. Virtual memory is important because if you run out of virtual memory, we crash. Memory, though, is kind of more classically important for driving performance. When you look at applications, especially like database, you can think about memory both in terms of using the for application processing as well as memory as a cache, right? The cache is interesting because it essentially speeds up I/O performance. Right? And so cache, while it's memory, it really impacts disk performance, not kind of driven by memory performance. So one mistake which I see with memory, virtual memory, is your swap consumption. Like, oh my gosh, I have something swapped out. That is a problem. Not a problem unless you run out of swap, run out of virtual memory and may crash. The swap activity is what you should be watching, right? In this case, there's, let's say, some minimal swap activity, you know, maybe 2 kilobytes a second, not a big deal. Yes. Another interesting thing, if you want to look at the memory usage by the applications, in many cases we look at the at what? Virtual memory and resident memory. What is the problem with virtual memory? Especially for something like Go application, it can be insane, right? In this case, well, it's not quite insane, but it's 4 gigabytes on 1 gigabyte physical memory VM, right? So I might say, oh my gosh, sky should be falling. You know, not really, right? We can, of course, look at the resident memory. The problem for resident memory is it doesn't include their information what was swapped out, right? Which can be, if a lot of a process is swapped out of a process you don't expect to be, that can be, problematic. The good thing is both in STOP and in general, you know, ProcFS, there is actually a VM swap field, which shows you how much of a process was swapped out, right? And that can help you to understand resident size group swap size is actually how much of a memory that process is actually using, right? Not a VCZ, right, which is just bullshit. Free memory. Some people are very concerned when they have a free memory getting close to zero, right? But memory, free memory getting close to zero is cool, right? That actually means your kernel is using memory for a good purpose, such as a cache. Instead, you should look at the available column, which is actually the memory which kernel sees as available. It can, you know, easily to throw away some pages. If your available memory is getting very low, that is when you would have some, memory-driven problems and shortages. In terms of network, we should be looking at three things: bandwidth latency and packet loss. Also, would be seen as errors, right? And from a network standpoint, you can think about network from a global standpoint. Right, it is actually quite hard to observe, and the local, which is between kind of you and the switch. In terms of latency, for various reasons, the best way to measure the latency is actually at your application level. Right, just ping between two endpoints that may give you good idea about the network latency I expect, but may not be, especially in case network gets loaded or something like that. Right, so. External measurements, we can do ping or MTR, right, which gives us more information about, you know, where packet loss potentially happens, right, and where latency originates. Another interesting piece about the network, which I think often unmeasured, is a part of a DNS lookup, right? We often say, hey, we do DNS, and when we connect, the DNS is kind of supposed to be magic slow. It says to be cached, right? But in reality, it can be slow, especially with bad DNS configuration, especially for reverse DNS. Again, we can use tools from that BCC connection, which gives us some good idea. Network bandwidth, again, you just need to make sure you know your limits, wherever there's a network storage limit, so maybe something placed new on as a VM. Over cloud, because if you are going to be saturating network 100%, you will see queuing happening, right? And that's not good for your application, especially some of application relying on sending a lot of small packets, maybe starving, right? When you're pushing, some large packets through a network. Another thing from networks, the local network standpoint, you want to make sure there is no errors, right? Typically, there is none, but even if there are some few, maybe you have bad cable, bad drivers, bad network, you know, just fix it, right? Or get a new VM, right, if it's in the cloud. Retransmits, that is another very important thing, right? Because a lot of the network performance problems between two endpoints happens because of a packet loss and retransmits, not because of a speed of light is too slow, right? Especially, well, I mean, if you're in relative proximity, you can and should watch retransmits. Some will happen, but they shouldn't be high. In this case, actually, like 3% retransmit rate, that is pretty damn high, right? So, right. again, our wonderful EPF and BCC tools, they allow us to go beyond the globals, and you can actually see what specific connections got retransmitted, and that often can get you and say, if somebody says, oh, I have this kind of thing in my application log, this request took 5 seconds, right? We can say, oh, that corresponds to the network. Okay, look at that. I had to speed up in the end, but looks like I am right on time. I hope that was helpful. No?